The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Are you ready? It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 162 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm really glad you're listening because you're going to get to enjoy my fun interview with PJ Holden, one of the creators of the Department of Monsterology series, which is blossoming up into a series of trade paperbacks. I'm really glad to hear. We talk about the book and how it came to be and what it's like to work on a book about monsters and what he thinks of other monsters in today's comics world. We'll also talk about things coming in the future and how he's doing personally. So I'm sure you're going to be interested in what he has to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. Talking today with PJ Holden, one of the creators of Department of Monsterology, as well as working on Johnny Woo, Rogue Trooper, the 86ers, and of course Judge Dredd. How are you doing today, PJ?
Yay, I'm grand. Oh, you stole all that from my Wikipedia entry, didn't you?
Yes.
I can tell.
Yeah.
I've also done things like RoboCop Terminator 2 as well.
Oh, great. Number Crunchers too? Was that one of yours?
Number Cruncher, yeah. Number Cruncher with Simon Spurrier, creator-owned book, was out 2 years ago, I think, last year, a couple years ago.
Great. So you've got a lot of experience with these kinds of things, especially with doing some new stuff as well as using established franchises and things like that.
Yeah, well, I kind of much prefer making it from a whole cloth, as it were. Mm-hmm. I'm a child of 2000 AD, so I tend to like to create anything with big monsters and spaceships and things like that. Not so much superhero stuff, but definitely kind of the odd, peculiar things, and getting the chance to draw an entire story is the best. Mm-hmm. Is the best thing. Oddly, I've never really done any bits and pieces. Most of the work I've done has been entire stories rather than segments of it. You know, it's not part two of three or whatever. I kind of much prefer doing that.
That's good. Well, that's most of the way to do it these days, it seems like. Although you have to say, like with a Batman book, if you were to draw Batman, you would have to have him come along and then you'd have to leave it in such a place where somebody else could come along and do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the advantage. The sort of stuff that I've been doing has not been like that. I mean, I can pretty much take these characters and do whatever I want with them. And then, I mean, they don't go back into a toy box. They're usually mine. Or 2000 AD, actually, if they're 2000 AD exists, apart from Judge Dredd, you can usually put them back in broken. And the next next person has to take them out and fix them. So that's kind of fun. But I suppose I've never really been mad tempted to do a Batman book. I'm not jonesing for a Batman or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it would be fun to do. I'm sure it would be enormous fun to do something.
Yeah, get a chance. That's one of the bad things is that over here in the States, we don't get exposure to your work very often. And
no. To be fair, there's not an awful lot of my work to be exposed to. Last year was a particularly awful year for me. Oh. My kids weren't well. I wasn't well. And so in the end, I've produced very few actual pages of work. So there's very little of mine out there. This year, on the other hand, I'm coming out of the gates kind of firing on all cylinders and other such cliches and kind of hoping to get a good few hundred pages actually in print this year. So there should be far more of me out there.
Okay. While we're on the subject, I usually ask this at the end. What projects are you working on that we should be looking forward to?
I'm working on book 2 of Monstrology, and that's the big, big thing. And I'm just about finished. I think it's going to be, we don't have hard set plans just yet. I suspect it's going to be a graphic novel, and it will be sort of equivalent to a 5-issue series in a graphic novel, I think. Okay. So there might be other plans about digital distribution and stuff around that, but that's what I've been sort of concentrating on drawing part of last year and all of this year so far. I'm finished part 2 of that, the second chapter of it, so there's another 3 chapters to go. So that's going to see me through most of the next couple of months. And then after that, I have another project on the books, but I can't talk about it. That's the thing I used to love about when I was doing stuff in the small press, which is, you know, you get a little gig in the small press, you could tweet and you talk about everything you're doing, and you could share, and then it would be, people would see it. They may never even see the printed book because, you know, it's generally small press distribution is tiny, but they would often see your artwork if they don't see the book. Whereas when you're doing professional stuff with professional distribution, yeah, I find myself sitting on my hands going, I can't talk about any of this. I can't say anything about this at all. Right. So it's slightly frustrating, but it's the way it works, really.
Well, it's actually a good thing if you can't talk about it, because that means something good is in the works.
Yeah, I'm working on one other project, which is very much in my particular wheelhouse. And then after that, hopefully should be out this year. And after that, then I have another thing lined up, which will be, again, very much to my taste. So if you like the sort of things I like, which is Monstrology, then you'll like the other projects I get to work on. I've been very lucky in that I tend to get offered things that suit me and that are kind of keyed to my taste. So, or maybe I just generally don't get offered other things. Maybe that's what it is. But optimistically, I think I'm offered things that I like.
Good. Well, that's good, because then you can do a good job with it. It's often the case that if you really enjoy what you're doing, you'll have a better product come out as a result of it.
Yeah, I've definitely been guilty in the past of taking on projects which I sort of haven't enjoyed drawing on, and it translates very poorly into the artwork. You know, you can see that my heart's not in that. On the other hand, I kind of think that you have to reach a point as an artist where you can enjoy anything. You know, you can turn your hand to a thing that maybe isn't to your taste and still produce work. You know, whether the key to that is finding something in the work that you enjoy. I mean, way back when I started drawing comics professionally, I did work for Warhammer, and I don't know if you know Warhammer, but the Games Workshop, so they do Warhammer 40k, which is far future stuff, and they do Warhammer, which is kind of, I suppose it's like Lord of the Rings kind of style fantasy. And the editor said to me early on, he said, "What is there anything you don't want to do?" I said, "Look, give me any of the future stuff, I am your man for, but don't give me any of the fantasy." He went, "No problem." So then, of course, he offered me some fantasy work. And being a naive kind of freelancer, assuming that you should never turn down work, I went, "Yeah, all right, then I'll do that too." But boy, I really did not enjoy drawing it. So I was sort of sitting drawing it going, this is not a thing for me. But, you know, you sort of come around to it later. Like, I've read and watched things that are sort of historical, very old historical fiction. And it's weird. There's a point in history where things are so alien to the present day that they're almost like an alternative reality. And you can watch them with that viewpoint. Like, for example, and this isn't historical reality at all, but Game of Thrones, for example, is a pure fantasy thing. But I mean, you could also watch it from the perspective of it being a kind of weirdly futuristic thing where technology is magic, and or a thing set in an alternative Earth. I mean, you can turn anything into the thing that you love, and then you can enjoy drawing it. I don't want to test that theory, but if I have to, I will. That's my current thing. If I get offered a fantasy gig or something, which I feel isn't kind of what I want to do, if I can't turn it down for whatever reason, I will try and bend it to a way that that I know I will enjoy it. But I think that's true as well in terms of any sort of drawing. It's like those things that you're weak at drawing, mm-hmm. you've got to learn how to love to draw them. I remember years and years ago, a friend of mine said to me when I was struggling drawing hands, he'd say, you've got to learn to love drawing hands. Mm-hmm. And you do. It's because it's only when you make that mental shift where you go from, I don't draw hands very well and I hate drawing hands, to I don't draw hands very well, but I love drawing hands. Mm-hmm. That's when you improve, you know, that's when you get better. So it's a mental shift more than it is any other kind of trick. But once you can unlock that little door, then, you know, where's your oyster in terms of what you can draw then?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear the story about Steve Ditko? He drew in one of the Spider-Man books. He was always criticized for feet. He couldn't draw feet very well. The arches were like huge on the foot, and they're going through this museum, and there's this person, you don't see his face or anything, and he's looking at this picture, and it's a picture of a foot, and he goes, boy, I wish I could draw like that. And that was supposedly Mr. Ditko responding to all the criticism about the feet that he always got. So you have to do those kinds of things. You have to kind of figure out how to make those things actually work if you can. But it was funny to watch your comment about that.
Or you could figure out tricks to it. That's it. If you can't make them work, figure out the tricks. There's a lot of rubble and there's a lot of smoke and there's no more feet. That's the end of that one.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and get into Department of Monsterology. Can you talk a little bit about how this book came to be and what it's actually about? Because there's still some folks over here that probably haven't heard of it, and we want to make sure to get the word out.
All right, okay. Well, in a nutshell, so Department of Monsterology is about a university department who have three field teams that go out investigating all sorts of strange phenomena. One of the field teams is Team Carnacki, who investigate anything that goes bump in the night. So they look out for vampires and werewolves and all those kind of horror type genre things. And in this world, these things are all real. These are not a university team looking intellectually in that, you know, when they go looking into the, you know, the history of vampires, they find vampires. Mm-hmm. And there's, so Team Carnacki deal with supernatural elements. Team Challenger deal with the dinosaurs on mysterious islands and lost worlds, lost in time, that kind of thing. And then Team Carter are the space team. And Team Carter went mysteriously missing years ago. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of an ongoing mystery about what's happened with them. But that's the basis of the book. And I mean, if you're a fan of pulp fiction kind of novels, you'll note that Carnacki, Challenger, and Carter, of course, are all named for great pulp fiction characters. And Gordon, who writes it, is, you know, he really loves this stuff. And that's the angle we approach it from. I mean, it's been compared a lot to BPRD. Mm-hmm. And I love BPRD, but I think BPRD comes at it from a different angle where it takes kind of folk tales and make them real. Whereas we come at it from a kind of, let's take these pulpy monsters and turn them into really more pulpy monsters. So book one basically deals with the big bad monsters in it are the hopping Chinese vampires, the Jiangxi, which are all from a film called Mr. Vampire. Or where we first encountered them actually was a film called Mr. Vampire. And in Chinese myths, vampires, see, we call them vampires. They're not really vampires. They're kind of soul-sucking corpses that are, their bodies are entirely stiff, so they can only move by hopping. So that's one particular monster we have in there. But we also have these fishmen that are Cthulhoid kind of fishmen and big tentacled beasties and also and dinosaurs and all sorts. And I've said to people before when they've looked at the graphic novel, the cover on it, and I don't know if you've got a hard copy of or whether you've just picked it up digitally, but the trade paperback has a beautiful embossed cover on it. It just feels really nice. So I sort of give it to people. I say, I feel that cover, and they feel the cover and they go, oh, that's really nice. I said, yeah, see, all the promise of that cover we deliver. Everything I think that book's going to be about. I mean, I designed the logo, the Department of Monsterology logo. It was very important for me that the logo reflected the kind of thing we were going for. I mean, the logo sets the tone for the book, and the logo is a very kind of pulpy 50s, 60s kind of pulp movie novel kind of thing. It's got all of those elements in it. And even just the name Department of Monsterology is just, it's slightly goofy. So it's funny and it's ridiculous. It's over the top. And I'm doing the latest one now. I don't want to spoil any of it for anyone, but the things in it, if you thought the Chinese hopping vampires were the most over the top thing we could include, you have seen nothing, my friend, nothing. There's very, I mean, I just want to tell everyone what's in it, but then I don't. But I mean, there are pages where I was sitting drawing the other day, and I was just drawing it and laughing, laughing furiously to myself, going, "This is ridiculous. this is insane." So this sort of thing makes me laugh. And Gordon, I've known Gordon for maybe 15 years, Gordon Rennie, and the first time we met, we'd done some small press stuff together, and I had then got, I sort of translated that small press stuff into working for 2000 AD, and Gordon had already been working for for 2080 for a number of years then, and so he sort of helped me get early scripts and get work from 2080. Oh, cool. And so I went to Edinburgh to meet him about 14, 15 years ago. We sat down and we talked about things we both liked, and one of the first things we talked about was Mr. Vampire and the Hoppin' Chinese Vampires, and that became our goal. So it's a book that's, you know, this first book of Department of Monsterology is 15 years in the making. It's from a silly seeded idea where we just laugh at, you know, aren't those vampires, those hopping vampires are just brilliant, to actually drawing a page and turning these kind of slightly silly things into scary things. Mm-hmm. Just on the sheer volume of them. And Gordon, I think Gordon's a brilliant writer, and he can turn these things that I think are insane, silly ideas into really kind of scary, ominous. And now we have a big team. And I mean, one of the most interesting criticisms I think we got in the first book was there's so much going on. There's almost too much going on. Compared to most American comics, there's a lot of plot. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But that's because we come from 2080, where you've got 6 pages to tell a story. Mm-hmm. So when you suddenly go from 6 pages for a story to 22 pages in one issue, mm-hmm. you don't slow down. You don't go, right, let's pace ourselves a bit better here. Uh-huh. You keep going, and you keep going at that rate. I think everyone that's read it has really loved it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a book that causes you to lift it and go, meh. It's the sort of thing, if you're interested in the cover, you'll love the book.
Okay, well, it's interesting because you mentioned the monsters, and, you know, right now we're in the middle of a zombie phase where everybody's, it's all zombie stuff, and I have to be honest with you, in that reading the book, I loved seeing monsters that were not the usual monsters that we see.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact that we have these Jiangshi, the hopping Chinese vampires, we weren't going to touch vampires, but if we were going to touch vampires, that would be the vampires we'd touch. from early on, I mean, Gordon and I have a very similar sort of low boredom threshold, so we're things that start affecting us very, we get bored of very quickly, and both of us were long bored of zombies years ago. I mean, you know, we were never going to go near zombies. I don't know if we will. If we do go near zombies at all, it will probably be much closer to the black and white movies, like the original zombie movies, if we do, but I doubt we very much will. I'll often suggest things to Gordon, and, you know, as low as my boredom threshold is for these things, his is even lower. And so he will go, no. And he will often dig down deeper into a thing and come up with something in a kind of an unexpected way. But we were never going to hit Dracula-style vampires. I don't think that was never going to be our thing. And again, I'd love to talk about this next bit. But you know, some of the ideas in it are like, they're so flipped on their head that you think, wow, that's a... why did no one do that before, you know?
Yeah. So the good news is we won't get to see you have vampires seduce teenage girls.
No. That was never going to... I mean, I think the one highly charged sexual relationship in the book, and it's not that kind of book. I mean, I think aside from maybe one slightly naughty word, our book can be read by all ages. We don't push the all ages aspect of it, but I think we have a lot of strong female characters. It's a fun book. And I the kind of art I do isn't visceral. If I draw someone being decapitated, you're not going to see entrails, and it's not going to make you sick. You know, it's the sort of thing that you're going to go, whoa, that was cool. That's how I approach artwork. But yeah, the one highly charged relationship that's in the book running through it is between a girl and a robot. You know, you know, Harry the Wilmington, who is basically a brain in a jar inside a giant robot. Mm-hmm. So that's the one kind of relationship. You're not going to see Twilight twinkly vampires, and you're not going to see... I can't even see Gordon sort of spoofing them. You know, it'll be, you know, the things that we like are largely film kind of stuff, and it's taking some of those things and mixing them again and coming up with something old but new, you know.
Well, that's a good thing, because honestly, monsters have become pushed down into things. You know, it used to be back in the days of the 50s and the early 60s, you had all these where monsters dwell type books, and those were kind of fun actually to read a lot. And then, of course, superheroes came along and knocked all that stuff back.
You know, funny, I was talking to my son this morning. My son's 10, he just read the first Spider-Man, and he was asking me about when Spider-Man first appeared, and it was Tales of the Astonished. And I was kind of saying, you know, before Spider-Man, all of those comics were about monsters, and Groot was a monster, and I loved those books. I mean, by the time I got them, books that got shipped to the UK were, you know, they were, I think you might have heard the stories about early comic books were used as ballast on boats. They would ship them over, and purely as a way to keep the boat sort of at a certain depth in the water. And My dad was a wheeler dealer, antique type. He would go to all the antique fairs and markets and stuff, and he would just pick up things. And so I ended up, I mean, a lot of the Steve Ditko monster books and horror stories and the science fiction books, all of those things passed through my hands. And I loved them all. I mean, I really, really did love them. And then that love translated into things like 2000 AD, which was much closer to that sensibility than Captain America or something, wasn't it? It's not to say I don't like those books, but, you know, the monster runs deep within me, I think, is it? Yeah. The other thing I would say is when we talked about monsterology, it was like, you know, if we were going to do a monster book and we were going to call it monsterology, God, there better be a lot of monsters in it.
Yeah.
You know, this was not going to be a book where, oh, look, and now everyone's fighting towards the end of the fourth chapter where we finally meet your monster. This is going to be, you're going to see 1,000 fish men and on a page, which we're then going to throw away and ignore because that's not the main bad guy. Mm-hmm. The main bad guy are 1,000, what do you call them, warriors that are going to crack open to reveal Hobbit and Chinese vampires who are guarding an even scarier monster. You know, that's the kind of thing we do.
Well, that was the good thing too. Also, you had layers to your story. You didn't just have, you know, like the thing about The Walking Dead, and I enjoy The Walking Dead, what gets you is that the zombies only show up occasionally. They are there to cause some things to go a different direction when things start.
But it's not really, I mean, it's no more a zombie thing than, you know, The Walking Dead. And I, to be honest with you, I read the first few books, and I think our first son was born, and I just couldn't stomach reading them anymore. and then I kind of watched the first series of the TV show, and afterwards I thought, you know what, this is just exhausting. It's just, why am I doing this to myself? But to me, the zombies in The Walking Dead are the catalyst for the characters, you know, and I think the most telling thing is that flip reveal in, I can't remember, in the end of the first book or wherever, where one of the characters turns around and realizes we are the Walking Dead.
Yes,
you know, it's about them. It's not about the monsters at all.
That's true.
Monsters, I mean, it could well be about a rampaging horde of Zulu warriors. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be about zombies. It's about a bunch of people surviving in a post-apocalyptic situation. So, you know, you could take the zombies out and that would be, it would change the story, obviously, but it wouldn't change it that much because it's about those characters and those relationships, whereas ours is about the monsters.
Yeah.
I think the monsters out and our team don't have much to do, you know, and it's like, I hesitate to use the phrase monster of the week, but it does feel a bit like monster of the page, you know. It's which monster are we in for this scene, you know. Gordon and I often talk about and joke about the idea that, you know, you'll do books or you'll see books where characters are talking in hallway. They're walking along corridors talking about the terrible things that are happening outside. And it's like, why are we not seeing the terrible things? Why are we with these characters that see the terrible things? You know, so that, and that's, and again, that, all of that stuff feeds into kind of what I think we're trying to do with the book. And that's, you have a really kind of fast-paced, fun romp, you know, as much as anything. You know, if you're the sort of person who would have loved 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Land the Time Forgot and Mr. Vampire and all those movies are all in the mix and stirred in a big pot, and out comes Department of Monstrology. This is one big plug for Department of Monstrology, I realize.
Yeah, but, well, that's what we're talking about, so that's perfect sense. Now, one of the things I also noticed, too, was that some of the humans have extra human parts to them, like Samwise, and for you, you mentioned Harry. He's actually a brain inside of a robot.
Yeah, the characters are all, they're all carrying their own skeletons, and I think there's maybe in the team the only character you could put your finger on and say that character doesn't appear to have any kind of weirdness going on with them at all. Even that. That's not going to play out like that, I'm pretty sure. Every character in it has something sort of going on, and I think that's, again, a testament to Gordon's writing. He will get bored quickly. He's not going to introduce a character that has nothing, you know, that is just, hello, I'm exposition person, I'm going to tell you exactly what's happening here, and so please someone explain the plot to me while the monster chases us. You know, so all of the characters have their own things. I like that. And the characters in Team Carnacki, there's a character who's kind of sort of magician type, you know, with it spelt with a K, you know, he's that kind of chaotic. And even then, he's not quite what he seems, and none of the characters are quite what they appear to be.
Well, that's good. Now, one of the things I enjoyed about your artwork, too, is that you draw the monsters very clearly and very well, so they're interesting to look at, but also the humans and the human expression, I think you do extremely well. And so I thought that one of the things that propels the book along to me, well, there's a picture of one of the Chinese vampires getting his head cut off, and he's got his eyes are like, ah, you know, he's got big bulging eyes. And I got a huge kick out of that, because not only are they zombies, but you're putting expression into the humans as well and the non-humans.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was great.
I'm really at heart a cartoonist. And so to me, I've drawn, I don't want to, not spoil it, but I've drawn a couple of big robots in this next book, and they're big clunky robots. Mm-hmm. Really, if they were drawn realistically, you know, they wouldn't have the momentum and movement in them. But because I'm sort of a cartoonist, I can see the shape and how the shape would lend itself to a wee bit of cartooning. So it sort of bend and curve the metal a little bit more than it should do. So you get actually quite a surprising amount of expression out of these robots that are basically like large bars of soap. with you know, that's the sort of body shape is a large bar of soap, and a little kind of robot head that's nothing but a helmet with one eye on it. There's, you know, it's, to me, things like Wall-E, you know, it's realistic, but it's not. There's life and movement in everything. And that to me is, Rob Williams, a great friend of mine, Rob, he likes pointing out when I say things on Twitter that are so over the top that he goes, yeah, well, you're never going to work again, are you? And I posted a while ago, it was a couple of years ago, actually, I think, something like, I abhor realistic artwork. And it was a strong sentiment, but I was kind of meant it in my own artwork. I don't lean towards realism. I can't lean towards realism. And I think artists that do lean towards realism, it cuts them off at the knees a little bit. Yeah. It means that they can't, how do you put foreboding and menace into a rock? You know, how do you in 2001, the obelisk is there, and it's menacing and it's foreboding, but it's really he's done that by the frame of the angle and stuff. How do you make that constantly menacing and shoot it from different angles? There's only some angles that'll work at. Whereas if you're a cartoonist, you can make anything look scary or funny with movement. I mean, having said that, I don't want to go over the top. It's not Looney Tunes, but there's a great Chuck Jones expression, which every podcast I've ever been, I quoted it, which is that when Bugs Bunny gets squashed by a hammer, that's not how it would actually look, but that's how it would feel. You know, that's my art leans towards how it feels rather than how it looks. Okay. That's why what I'm saying about being, you know, I've got characters being decapitated, really. I'm not trying to show this is what that would look like. I'm trying to show this is what this would feel like. This is how the movement of this would feel and how the character's face would look. And I think there's a couple of scenes where characters lose their heads, and you can tell by the expression on their faces. They're looking down and going, what's just happened there? A realistic artist might be sitting there going, oh, this is what I'll have to study this. And I personally think by trying to inject more life into it, you steal all the life out of it. So it's a tough road to get down the middle of, because you want to make sure that it's believable and fun looking artwork that a character or that a reader will enjoy and not be torn out of. You know, they're not going to look at it and go, why does that character suddenly look really goofy or whatever. But and I don't always fall on the right side of it. I don't always fall on the kind of keeping the reader movement. But I'm kind of, because the script moves along at such a pace and the artwork has to keep up with that, I do try and keep that sort of forward momentum with the characters and the artwork and stuff, and try and sort of give them all a nice big range of facial expressions. Mm-hmm. I do have quite a goofy looking face, which helps. So.
Well, you made me think of, there was an amazing Spider-Man book in which Peter Parker reveals that he's Spider-Man to his Aunt May. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, for a whole book, them talking to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't a more boring book that came out that year. You know, there they were sitting.
It's tough. I mean, it's tough to do. I feel sorry for any artist that has to do. I always find scenes like that where characters have to sit around and talk about plot. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they're the white bread of a sandwich. You know, they are needed sometimes, but they're hard to get any enjoyment out of. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for readers and artists. The problem is writers like them, I think. Writers enjoy them because they're dialogue heavy and there's a lot of dialogue in them. And that's the kind of meat of what they enjoy doing often. Mm-hmm. But a heavy, like two heads talking through an entire thing can be... I mean, having said that, you know, if you're a really much better artist than me, you can find the juice to enjoy out of that. But I would struggle a bit, I think.
Well, I saw an interview with the artist, and he said about what a struggle it was for him to come up with different views of the same face over and over. Yeah. And then
the thing is, if you're the more you lean towards realism, mm-hmm. the harder I think a scene like that gets, because then all you can really do is play with camera angles.
Yeah.
Whereas if you lean towards cartoony, mm-hmm. I mean, I could sit the camera on exactly the same angle and get all sorts of strange expressions out of a face mm-hmm. that are over the top and maybe not appropriate, but mm-hmm. you know, I could get all sorts of expressions out of exactly the same angle. So mm-hmm. it's easier, I think, if you lean towards cartoony for stuff like that. I mean, like, you know, I can picture in my head now, say, Scotty Young drawing 10 pages of one person's talking head. You know, I can see that, and I can see how that would still be interesting after 10 pages, because mm-hmm. he would get an awful lot of life in that one talking head, you know. Whereas there are other artists like Alex Ross that painted, if it was exactly the same angle, the same talking head in the same shot, it wouldn't be anywhere near as interesting. Mm-hmm. And yet, mm-hmm. it's not because he's a bad artist. It's mm-hmm. just because the nature of that kind of realistic artwork is that I think you need to play with more than just the expression. You know, you need to play with angles and all sorts of things to keep it interesting.
Yep, sounds good. And to give credit to Gordon, too, Gordon Rennie, who was one of the scripters.
Let's not give him any credit. I think I've credited him enough. Alex Bimbo should get a lot of credit for backing us and getting mm-hmm. behind us. Mm-hmm. Jim Campbell, even though he complains never ending about the fact that we use upper and lowercase letters, you know, he does a great job on the book. Steve Denton does a great job in colouring it, and we've all been together from the start. Gordon, you know, Gordon gets far too much. No, I'm only joking. He deserves a lot better.
Well, one of the things that I enjoyed very much about the book, about the individual miniseries now that's collected into a volume, you get to see at the very end, you have a cliffhanger there for us. And we won't spoil that here, but it has to do with one of the mysteries that you've alluded to you know, previously. And I was so shocked when I got to that. And of course, I love the book. You know, I love the book, and I was going like, wow, what a great book. And then to get hit with a cliffhanger at the end, I was just literally going like, they have to do another one of these. We can't go with this. We've got to have more to explain, you know, what happened at the cliffhanger and what other stuff are going on. Because there's plenty of monster stuff to do that everybody does doesn't do. So I was so happy to hear you say that you're already working on
the great news is Alex Bimbo, who's our publisher, had asked Gordon and I if we would commit to doing 5 books the next 5 years. So, and we said yes. And the bad news is that means there will probably be cliffhangers ongoing. But you know, I mean, I'm sure you'll verify that particular cliffhanger was to one part of the story. The overall arc of that story was is neat. You know, is all in that one book. But there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of, you know, because we don't explore the backgrounds of any of the characters, really. You know, we get a little bit into one or two of the characters, and there's a great big reveal where you find out that Harry, the big robot guy, is actually a brain in a jar.
Yeah.
And we find out in the trade paperback there's a little one-off episode which kind of details his personal history mm-hmm. as well. So we explore the backgrounds of some of the other characters in the other book, and that particular cliffhanger we start looking at as well. You'll be pleased mm-hmm. to hear.
Oh, so, good. Because that was one of the things I really enjoyed about the trade was be able to see this other story where we delve a little bit more into Harry's background.
Yeah, yeah.
And what goes into that. Because, you know, the great thing about the trade now, if we refer to it in that term, is that we get a lot going on. But now that we understand the storytelling and we get the idea of what they're going to be doing, what kinds of things they're involved with, it's good to build in the characters a little bit more.
Well, there's three teams. Each team has about 4 or 5 characters. And then there's a kind of their support network back at the university. Mm-hmm. And you know, the story in that first trade, the story isn't really about any of those teams. It's about a whole set of incidents that go on. And so we cover the sort of who they are and the building of the teams, and or not the building of the teams go off their adventure. Mm-hmm. We don't actually waste an awful lot of time in getting the reader all set up and ready for it. We just fire ahead. Wow. You know, which is great, I think. It's great. Mm-hmm. But as I say, each of those characters has their own kind of big history. And then I think we touch very lightly on Team Carter, the space team that go missing.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other trade book on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. whatever's happened there, I don't know what's happened there. Gordon hasn't told me. But Gordon probably doesn't know.
Not yet, anyway.
For many readers, and I don't want to take the, for some people they'll hate this, and some people will love this. To me, I love this, but for some people it's a peek behind the curtain too far. people think writers often build like massive boards with all these interconnected threads of where books are going to and where they're coming from and so on. Whereas I think what most writers actually do is they throw out a bunch of random words, and then later on when they go to pick them up again, they go, oh, look, I could do that and this. And it's that fact they've set up all these kind of random things that they then go back in and start connecting themselves. And that's where the real magic of writing is being able to kind of connect all those dots together. And suddenly, you know, it looks like they're throwing out random dots on a dot-to-dot drawn. And they are, you know, they're often random dots. But then when they go back in and they start drawing around it, suddenly you've got this fully connected story and you go, wow, that's amazing. You know, and all of that was there and they must have planned that. No, they didn't all plan it, but it feels like they've planned it all along. So it means it's as much an adventure for me and Gordon drawing it, writing it, and well, he's writing it, but I'm drawing it, and it means we're never sort of bored, which I think hope comes through. You know, we're having a blast. But, you know, and this new book, particularly this, I think last year, because of my kids not being well and me not being well, I ended up drawing very, very little. I think over the course of most of a year, I think I drew 30, 40 pages. It wasn't a lot. But this year, we're in the 17th, I've drawn, or we're in the 18th, I've drawn 17 pages, I think, already. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of hit a page a day. And they've been good pages. This is not sort of cutting corners. This is kind of sitting my backside down at a drawing table and just drawing constantly. Mm-hmm. And I think the current sequence I've just done in Monsterology is some of the best artwork I've ever done. Think.
Great.
And I say that with I know other people have kind of looked at some of the pages of Monsterology and gone, oh, this is the best stuff you've ever done. And I'm kind of looking at it going, wait till you see what I've just done. Yeah. Wait till you see this. You'll like this.
Yeah, well, what's really good is I was honored to have a quote from my review at Major Spoilers put in there. I gave it 5 out of 5 stars. And said that Department of Monsterology is the next big thing in comics, and I still believe that as people go along and are looking for something new and unique and enjoyable, I think that this book is going to only get bigger and bigger in the
we've got one trade out now, and we can hit the ground run. I mean, we sort of hit the ground run on the first one, but we can really hit the ground run on the second one and assume people have some notion of the background and history of these characters now and that they're interested in them. So now we can go off and go, I think you've got to be careful in setting the tone sometimes of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And once you've set the tone, then you can go off. If we introduce one of the bad guys that we've got, I don't want to call them monsters. Mm-hmm. They are monsters in their own way. Mm-hmm. You'll see when you see it. They are monsters in their own way. But if we'd hit this one before in the first trade, you'd have gone, this is preposterous and over the top. But now we've eased you into it, eased you into the world of Monsterology. Mm-hmm. These seem no more absurd than some of the other ideas because we've already eased you into the fact that this is the kind of world this is. This is the world where Lovecraftian monsters exist and where things that go bump in the night are often hopping Chinese vampires.
Mm. Well, it's great. Now, of course, you've teased us very effectively about the second series.
Sorry.
No, I love that. Now, of course, that leads to the question. Any ideas to when these things are going to hit the stands, is when we're going to get to see?
The third one is going to come out purely as a trade. In print, I think it'll purely come out as a trade. And I've just finished the second issue. Well, I'm nearly heading towards the second issue of it being released. So it'll be later end of the year, basically. That's where we're going for. And it'll be one book a year. It may well be we'll do digital version of it, may well be out digitally. I'm not sure, we haven't sort of set any of that stuff in stone just yet. I kind of want us to be in a position where we can do more than that, but I think if that comes, it'll have to be after a couple of years of the books being out and people knowing it, seeing it. But, you know, the Walking Dead wasn't the phenomenon it was in its first issue, you know, in its first book. Mm-hmm. It took a little while for that to grow and become big.
Well, are they going to be individual issues or is it just going to come out as a trade as a result of?
Well, in print, it'll come out as a trade. I think we've seen the last of it as individual issues, which is a shame because I do love the comic format and those comics issues were really nice to have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of other options now. There's digital distribution and so on. So it may well be, it may well come out in Comixology or something like that before a trade comes out. I mean, I don't know because we haven't agreed anything just yet. So I'm talking out of class, basically, and nothing sort of hard fixed yet. And I've only drawn 2 issues of it. So, and it's 5 issues really before it's complete. I think the original plan was to do a 4-issue trade and then a 5th issue that would be just a background story. Mm-hmm. But I think Gordon kind of feels this story needs a little bit more room to breathe. So it's going to be a big story, which will be, it's great fun. It really is. It's a bonkers. It is mad. It's It's easily the maddest thing I've ever done.
Oh, wow. That's great. Oh, yeah. See, all these things would love to start. At least get a part of it would be nice to have.
Well, so, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see I occasionally post little sneak peeks of artwork.
Oh, good.
So you'll definitely have seen already there are dinosaurs in it.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else about the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. because there's more than just that. But, mm-hmm. You know, there are definitely dinosaurs in it, mm-hmm. and evil people.
Yeah, well, you need those if you're going to have a good book. Yeah, so that's really great.
Absolutely. I mean, we had some great villains in the twins that were in the other book, or the brother and sister bad guys who kind of use their kind of weird psychic ability to hop bodies.
Yeah.
They were our sort of main villain in the last one, and this new one has got its own range of bad guys.
Does it have like a subtitle? Because the other first one was called Monsterology 101.
Yeah, well, funny, when we first proposed the book, it was called Monsterology. Mm. And we were kind of fishing around for a publisher, and Alex came on board as our publisher. And then after doing a couple of copyright checks and, doing a lot of checking on the title, we found that there was a book called Monsterology out, and there was also a comic coming out at the time called Monsterology. Mm. So we needed to find a new name. Mm-hmm. And Gordon was kind of playing around with a couple of names, and Monsterology 101 was one of them. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, at that stage, I'd already designed a Monsterology logo, and we all loved it. And we all kind of thought this logo was perfect and sold the book and didn't need to change if we could help it. Mm-hmm. And so Gordon was going, well, if we call it Monsterology 101, then that doesn't change the logo too much. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of going, well, I think I can get Department of Monsterology into the logo. Mm-hmm. Let me try that. So I got Department of Monsterology, and it fit in the logo nicely. Mm-hmm. So it became Department of Monsterology. Mm-hmm. And then we do the issues, and the issues come out. This is a few years down the line later. Mm-hmm. The issues come out, and the trade collection is being put together. And Alex, the publisher, says, look, we should maybe have a title for this. And Gordon's going, well, I have no idea I don't know what we should call it. You know, it's just Department of Monsterology, Book 1, something like that. And it was at that point I went, well, you know, we could maybe call it Monsterology 101 because that seemed to fit really well as a book title. So that's where the title came from. So I don't know. I have no idea what we'll come up with the second one. So it didn't fit as the name of the comic, but it fit really well as the name of the first trade. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want the second one to be called Monsterology 102. I don't know. Is that the way you name things in?
No.
Is that how it works? There's 201 is it?
Too predictable. You're going to do something different.
It'll have to be something very different. So I don't know. And at the same time, I don't want to spoil anything. So I don't want to kind of go, let's call it blah, name it after some of the monsters in there. But we'll think of something. Something will come. Don't you worry.
It'll be
Monsterology
great.
Well, if you see it when it comes out and it's called Monsterology Book 2, it means nothing came to us.
Well, PJ, I really enjoyed talking with you and really enjoyed the book, I think, Department of Monsterology. I'm really looking forward to all five collections of them, and I'm glad that you're doing it and you're enjoying it. And I really hope that this leads to many more good things for you because it's great stuff.
I hope it makes me rich, but in the end, it's easily the most fun book I've ever been involved with. So if it just remains one of those little books that I get to do for 4 or 5 years, then brilliant. But if it makes me filthy rich, then that's even better because then it means we can do more.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com. And that's it for this week. Be sure to be back next time when I'll have another great interview with yet another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.